Everyone, thank you for tuning into the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. It's August 2017, and you're listening to episode 48 of Postmodern Realities, and I'm Melanie Cogdill, managing editor of the Christian Research Journal. On this episode, I'm joined by David Hagopian, who is a partner with the California law firm Carruthers DeSante Freudenberger in Irvine, California, where he is a complex business litigation and consumer and employment defense trial attorney. He is also the editor and contributing author to several books and an allied attorney with the Alliance Defending Freedom. In 2013, David wrote an article for our Viewpoint column, and Viewpoint is a column that addresses relevant contemporary issues in discernment and apologetics from a particular perspective that not is usually shared by all Christians. So we hope that readers' thinking on Viewpoint issues will be stimulated and enhanced whether or not readers end up agreeing with the author. David's Viewpoint article is called Not Guilty, A Biblical Case for Ministering to the Accused, and it's free online at equip.org. David, it's good to have you on.
Thank you, Melanie. I'm glad to join you.
Well, a question that we've been asked in the past here at the Christian Research Institute, which is why we asked you to write this article, is that people call in or write in wondering if it's biblically appropriate or even unbiblical or unethical for Christians to be defense attorneys, especially, you know, when they're thinking of somebody defending someone who is on trial for serious crimes like sexual assault or murder, or armed robbery, or even some big kind of corporate white collar crime case. So why does it seem like this question of Christian attorneys representing guilty parties comes up all the time and people aren't comfortable with that?
Well, that's a great question, Melanie. I think, you know, many Christians are challenged by the idea or the very notion of being a Christian attorney in today's day and age. But as your question prefaces and assumes, most people don't have the same concerns when it comes to civil parties and civil lawsuits. The more vexing or challenging question usually arises in the context of Christian attorneys serving as defense lawyers in criminal cases. And I think that American popular culture and its portrayal of lawyers who represent guilty clients as villains or lawyers who violate every canon of ethics and betray their known guilty clients as heroes in movies like The Devil's Advocate and Justice for All and similar films, I think has a lot to say about that or plays a large role in our general perception of the ethical propriety of Christian lawyers serving as defense lawyers in criminal cases.
So do you think there's maybe an issue with the way the question is usually framed about whether a Christian attorney can represent someone that is considered guilty or is perceived as guilty?
Right. I think we have to keep in mind, you know, from the outset, Melanie, that the term guilt or guilty, those terms are actually legal terms of art. So asking if a Christian attorney can represent a guilty party actually begs the question that I think is at issue, since the term guilt is a legal term that applies only after trial, after a guilty verdict, as it were, i.e. a verdict saying that the accused is actually guilty of having committed the crime that he or she has been accused of committing, and only after all appeals have been exhausted. So that's really part of the quandary here, and part of the question begging is that the term guilty is a loaded term because it implies or assumes a certain legal outcome.
So does, you know, talking about this term guilty, does that mean that somebody particularly committed that crime, the defendant committed that crime?
Right, that's another great question. The simple answer is not really or not necessarily, since as we know from following, you know, news articles through the years, not every verdict is comes out the right way. Verdicts can be right or wrong. They can be true or false. So some notable cases over the last several years come readily to mind, especially based on recent news events. We can think of the O.J. Simpson verdict or the Casey Anthony verdict on the one hand, where the system at least appears to most to have broken down in that a wrong verdict was rendered in favor of innocence when the party should have been convicted of guilt. But then we also can think of really well-heeled projects like the Innocence Project, where they spend their lives and their careers exonerating people who have been wrongly convicted of crimes that they never actually committed. So, you know, we also have this phenomenon, too, I might want to add, because I think it's really important to keep in mind, of false confessions. Again, this is not necessarily my practice specialty, but false confessions are a very real phenomenon. People who, for some reason, confess to crimes they never actually committed and shouldn't be punished. And it complicates the issues even more so.
I think the hard thing, too, is a lot of times just as a person looking at the news, we make assumptions about things. I know for the first time in my life, I served on a jury a few years ago here in North Carolina, and I was hoping I wouldn't get picked because the case was felony child abuse, so all these people were trying to get out of it. But as you sat and listened to the trial, it's a lot more complicated than it seems on the outset, you know. So as someone's looking in, or even when a verdict is rendered and we hear about it in the news, we don't know because we weren't the parties involved, whether as a juror or an attorney or whatever. So what would you think is a more accurate way of framing this question, especially in light of some of the things that you mentioned?
Right. Well, first of all, I want to commend you for serving. You know, our entire system and my entire profession depends on people like you. I actually got called to serve once and actually became the foreman of a jury, and it surprised me that I was allowed to stay on the jury as an attorney. But I think the real way to get back to answering your question, the more accurate way of framing the question is it ethically proper or permissible for a Christian attorney to represent someone they already know committed the crime? I think that's the best way to frame it.
So what do you think is the real, I'd say, focus of this issue that we're talking about in terms of representing attorneys, Christian attorneys representing somebody who would be accused of a crime or guilty of a crime?
I'd like to suggest that the thrust of the issue is it proper for a Christian attorney on the defense side in this instance to put the state through the throes or force the state to prove its case? And I think that it's not inherently unethical or improper or unbiblical for a Christian attorney to do that.
You're listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest is David Hagopian. In 2013, David wrote a Viewpoint article called Not Guilty, A Biblical Case for Ministering to the Accused, and it's free online at equip.org. To read other thought-provoking Viewpoint articles, including an upcoming article called How to Revive a Dead Church, please subscribe to the journal. A six-issue subscription is $39.50, and to subscribe online, visit equip.org. We're talking about whether it's morally permissible for Christian attorneys to represent guilty defendants in a trial, if that's ethical. So, I guess the bottom line is, you know, the question is put to us, is this biblical? Is this unbiblical for someone to do this? So what's the starting point for tackling this issue and looking at it from a biblical point of view?
I think the starting point for us all as Christians is to turn to God and how He has revealed Himself in His Word, Melanie. Because we all believe that the Bible should serve as our standard for everything that we believe and everything we do. And I think that the Bible has a lot to say about this very issue, because the biblical starting point is the fact that God ordained all human governments, which includes their legal systems. And I think of passages like Romans 13, verses 1 through 7, in this light, where God has ordained all authorities, all civil authorities that be. Of course, this doesn't mean that all governments are just or completely righteous in all respects, but that's not what Romans 13, 1 through 7 is all about. God still ordains even imperfect governments and their legal systems.
You just mentioned that, you know, not every human or legal system is just, and that, you know, and you just talked about the Innocence Project too, and not all verdicts go the way that maybe the evidence is showing. So how can Christians, you know, feel like that they can participate? I was on a jury. If they think, well, there's been a lot of debate in our society recently about various different legal professions and law enforcement and whether or not they're just. So how does the Christian even look at government systems that God has ordained?
Right. Well, obviously, there's a great variety of governmental systems. If you look at various government structures throughout the world, in our country, we have a constitutional form of government that also has an adversarial system of justice, Melanie, which means that, you know, in the criminal context, we have the prosecution on one side and the defense on the other. In the civil realm, we have the plaintiff on the one hand and the defense on the other. So the when we're talking about, you know, various forms of government, our government has this adversarial system of justice, and it assumes at its core in the criminal context that a criminal defendant is innocent until proven guilty in accordance with notions of fundamental due process. And I think that that's really in all of our best interests, because to the extent that we presume those who are accused of having committed crimes, and we presume them to be innocent, and we put the state to the test of proving its case, this is a shield against governmental tyranny that actually protects all of us in our society. So there's nothing inherently unbiblical or unethical about our constitutional form of government and its adversarial system of justice that puts the burden on the state in the criminal context to prove or justify the harm it wishes to impose on the accused.
But is this notion of presumed innocence that you're talking about, that we, you know, all know, like you're innocent until proven guilty, is that even in the Bible?
Yes, I believe it is. And this is where the study becomes rather fascinating. If we start, first of all, in the Old Testament and go all the way back to Deuteronomy chapter 17, verse 6, God actually teaches us, and I'm going to quote some scriptures here because they're really important. Here's what Deuteronomy 17:6 says. It says, on the evidence of two witnesses or three witnesses, the one who is to die shall be put to death. The person shall not be put to death on the evidence of one witness. And then just two chapters later in Deuteronomy 19, verse 5, Melanie, God in his word says that a single witness shall not suffice against a person for any crime or any wrong in connection with any offense that he has committed. Only on the evidence of two witnesses or three witnesses shall a charge be established. So right there in that passage, God in his holy word tells us several things about presumed innocence versus guilt and the state being put to the test of proving its case against the accused.
Well, those are Old Testament passages. Are there any New Testament passages that talk about the concept of presumed innocence?
Yes, there are. But could I back up just for a moment, Melanie, and kind of comment on what I call three prosecution principles that actually emerge from those passages in the book of Deuteronomy? They teach us, first of all, that due process has to govern all prosecutions because the passage refers to any crime or any wrong. The second prosecution principle that I think we need to understand is that the burden of proving guilt has to be satisfied. In this instance, the famous biblical phrase of by two or three witnesses. And the third one is, I think, the pivot point for our discussion today. And that is, if this burden cannot be satisfied, in this instance by the prosecution or the state, the accused is not punished or convicted. What's interesting is those passages talk about a person shall not be put to death on the evidence of one witness, a single witness shall not suffice, and only on the evidence of two or three witnesses shall a charge be established. And the assumption of the passage, Melanie, is even if the accused actually committed the crime, because the one passage said any offense that he has committed. So those are the principles. Now, turning or pivoting to the New Testament, this isn't just an Old Testament phenomenon. The book of Hebrews warns believers to obey God, since some who violated the law, according to the author of Hebrews, quote, died without mercy on the evidence of two or three witnesses, close quote. That's Hebrews 10:28, where this two or three witness passage hearkening back to Deuteronomy is basically assumed. Also, no one in the church is to bring an accusation against a church elder unless they're surrounded by a company of witnesses. So elders are protected from charges of wrongdoing except by two or three witnesses. In 1 Timothy 5:19, Paul wrote, don't admit a charge against an elder except on the evidence of two or three witnesses. So those same principles from the book of Deuteronomy are applied even to the New Testament church. Also, in a church dispute between, say, two brothers or brothers and sisters, Christ taught that if the offending brother doesn't listen to you when you try to confront them about an offense that has been given or taken, you're supposed to take one or two others so that every charge may be established on the evidence of two or three witnesses. That's Matthew 18, verse 16. And then also Paul told the Corinthians in 2 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 1, this is the third time I'm coming to you. Every charge must be established by the evidence of two or three witnesses. So interestingly and intriguingly, the New Testament repeatedly assumes, applies, and extends this very principle of presumed innocence until proven guilt.
In your article, you suggest that a Christian attorney representing the accused is a picture of Christ. Could you explain that for us?
Yes. Christ, as we know, according to 1 John 2:1, is our advocate with the Father. And this is an interesting word. It can be translated as advocate. It can be translated as one who bestows or gives comfort as well. But the important spiritual point that I think we can all glean from this is that perfect people don't need an advocate. Only spiritually guilty people need a spiritual advocate in Christ. And that's indeed what John said. If anyone does sin, we do in fact have an advocate with the Father, and that advocate, of course, we know to be Jesus Christ, the righteous.
But see, you know, I always think of Christ as my advocate in terms of prayer, but also, you know, we're coming before, if we're non-Christians, we're coming before, you know, already guilty before God. And so wouldn't you say that Christ is both judging us on the basis of our sin and as well as, if we're Christians, advocating for us before God the Father?
Absolutely. The sad biblical truth, which is at the heart of the gospel, is that we all have sinned. We think of, you know, verses like Romans, you know, 6:23, the wages of sin is death, or in Ephesians 2, Colossians 2, that we were all dead in our trespasses and sins. So really what we're talking about, Melanie, spiritually speaking, is that we're all capital offenders before God spiritually. We may never have pulled a trigger on anyone in our lives, praise God, but according to Christ, we're spiritual murderers just the same if we so much as get unrighteously angry with a brother or sister without cause, according to the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 5. So the sad spiritual truth is that because we all have sinned, we all need Christ as our advocate with the Father.
So getting back to the original topic of, can Christian attorneys represent the accused? Are you saying that they could be represent the accused and be like Christ in that way?
Absolutely. Just to clarify, Christ is not just our advocate. He also comes first as our judge. So as judge, he pronounces the perfection of his holy law, his legal standard. He reads the charges against us. He pronounces the guilty verdict and the penalty that we deserve. The wages of sin is death. But then he comes along for those who, by God's mercy and grace, throw themselves upon him by faith. He comes along for them as their advocate. You know, he pleads for us. He defends us. He, as you mentioned a few moments ago, he intercedes for us, and he comforts us. So Christ is both judge on the one hand and advocate for those who throw themselves on him and look to him alone as their only hope in this life and the life to come. And because Christ has done that for us, and because we know that we are to strive by God's mercy and grace to live like him, we too are called to be advocates for him in this earthly realm.
Well, I know that this article helped me really think through this issue and change my mind about some things with regard to it. So thanks for writing the article. And so finally, I wanted to end with some fun rapid-fire questions for David. So David, would you rather eat tacos or a burger from In-N-Out?
I'd rather eat tacos.
And have you ever watched the TV program Judge Judy?
I have watched about 5 minutes of it at one point in my life.
And what book are you reading right now?
Well, I'm reading several books, but I'm reading a book on the constitutional form of government right now for my personal pleasure, if you can believe that.
Well, you live in Southern California, so what's your favorite thing about Southern California?
Our beautiful sunny weather most of the year. Although right now it's about as humid as it is for you where you live in the South. So it's a little bit uncomfortable at this time of the year.
Yeah, I heard it's kind of hot right now. Well, thanks, David, for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Today's guest is David Hagopian. And in 2013, David wrote in a Viewpoint article called Not Guilty, A Biblical Case for Ministering to the Accused. And it's free online at equip.org. To read more thought-provoking Viewpoint articles, please subscribe to the journal. A six-issue subscription is $39.50. And to subscribe online, visit equip.org. We'd like to hear from you, so connect with us on social media. Like the Bible Answer Man Facebook page and follow CRI, Christian Research Journal, Hank Anagraff, and the Bible Answer Man on Twitter. Follow the Bible Answer Man on Instagram. And please subscribe to the Bible Answer Man channel on YouTube. If you like this episode, please subscribe to the Postmodern Realities podcast on iTunes, and we need you to rate it and review our podcast. And please share this episode on your social media accounts. Be sure you turn in daily to the Bible Answer Man broadcast hosted by CRI President Hank Anagraff, who answers your questions live on air. To ask Hank a question, call 1-888-ASK-HANK Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. In addition, head to iTunes and subscribe to Hank Unplugged, Hank's new audio podcast. Follow Hank off the grid, where he has in-depth conversations with some of the brightest minds discussing topics you care about. So until our next Christian Research Journal author conversation, thanks for listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast.